Thanks. Well, thanks for having me here. I've never been in this room before, and this chair is really strange but wonderful. I didn't imagine myself when I was preparing for this to be thinking or to be speaking from a leather-bound chair with high armrests, but I think I'll enjoy it. Okay, so I guess so before I begin, this isn't from my doctoral thesis, or my doctoral research. I worked on Kant and moral character. And so I do kind of two things. I guess I do like history of philosophy, and my kind of way into that is Kant and some of the early moderns. And I really like ancient philosophy. I really like Aristotle and Plato, and try to read as much of them as I can. But I'm not a proper expert on that. So history of philosophy, and then of which I do like to say Kant, and then moral psychology, which is kind of like. It can be kind of confusing, I think, when you tell people that you do moral psychology, because philosophers often use it and sort of understand what it means, but it just means, like, if you think of philosophy of mind with respect to morality and, like, moral activity, moral behavior, action, deliberation, that kind of thing, that's what I do. So I'm just going to sort of set out some reflections on a passage from Romans, and we can talk about it and see what you think. So, I guess, why don't I open by reading the passage? Okay, so this is Romans 7, 14 to 25. And this is, of course, St. Paul speaking. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am of the flesh, sold into slavery under sin. I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. Now, if I do what I do not want, I agree that the law is good. But in fact, it is no longer I that do it, but sin that dwells in me. For I know that nothing good dwells within me, that is, in my flesh. I can will what is right, but I cannot do it. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I do. Now if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I that do it, but sin that dwells within me. So I find it to be a law that when I want to do what is good, evil lies close at hand. For I delight in the law of God in my inmost self. But I see in my members another law at war with the law of my mind, making me captive to the law of sin that dwells in my members. Wretched man that I am, who will rescue me from this body of death? Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then, with my mind, I am a slave to the law of God. But with my flesh, I am a slave to the law of sin. So this evening, I want to offer some philosophical reflections on this well-known passage from Romans 7. I do want to be sensitive to disciplinary differences here. I actually, by the way, first gave this talk at, I don't know if you know, DCM, the DCM conference, and the philosophy and theology stream, so it was actually originally kind of oriented towards, what I assumed would be a room full of theologians. But in any case, I do want to be sensitive to other disciplines, not just theologians, but others. So this isn't a philosophy paper just for philosophers. My intention is not to provide a complete or even a remotely thorough exegesis of the passage in the way that, for example, a New Testament scholar might do. My intention is rather to provide a more open-ended, conceptually oriented, and philosophical reading of the passage, which, while not complete, I take to be permissible in the case of the biblical text. So you might look at Joseph Butler and his sermons for a historical example of this. I don't know if you know Bishop Butler, but he's sort of well-studied by analytic philosophers, but a lot of his work is sermons, and he's kind of exegeting biblical texts, but in sort of, like I say, philosophical style. So that's a bit of a kind of a role model for this particular paper, you might say. Okay, so both standard human experience and logic will have to inform the work of any exegete. So this is where I think philosophy can be useful, since philosophy, or at least practical philosophy, takes standard human experience to be its subject matter and logic to be its tools for examining that subject matter. Of course, exactly how all these sources of what we might call knowledge should fit together so as to provide the best interpretation of Holy Scripture is an interesting question itself, and perhaps one that we can talk about further in discussion afterward. Regarding the structure of the reflections I'm going to offer, I'll begin by setting out some basic observations and questions concerning the passage itself. This is mostly to frame our thoughts and just to help us keep the passage in mind as we move on to the next stage. Then I want to turn to the philosophical problem of weakness of will. This part of the talk will be more or less separable from the rest of the talk. So if nothing else, this talk will have at least performed a pedagogical function, and you'll be able to leave with an understanding of the philosophical puzzle and some classic analyses of it. So in looking at this puzzle, I suggest we might keep in mind two broader questions. First, how might an understanding of the philosophical puzzle illuminate our understanding of the passage in Romans? Or maybe, in other words, what might it contribute to a theological understanding of this passage? Of course, in the background here will be the further question, what the best philosophical understanding of this puzzle is. Excuse me, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this. The second broad question is, how might our understanding of what's going on in this passage in Romans, for lack of better words, from a theological point of view, inform our conception of the philosophical puzzle, or how we look at it? Is there a particular way we ought to conceive of it, given what's said here in Scripture? So here I'm hoping to avoid, and hoping that we'll all avoid, the sort of dogmatic stance that would take the philosophical problem to be directly determined by some theological position. Though I think this sort of thing might be appropriate in some cases, so when I think of a kind of a strictly materialistic metaphysics would seem to be, if you hold to Christian belief, would be ruled out, or is at least inconsistent or incompatible with it. So, you could say that it's appropriate in some cases like that. But generally, I think both philosophy and theology and perhaps just reality are much more complicated than that. And so to pretend we already have all the answers and that we just need to point them out and apply them, kind of stamp them on to something that's deeply puzzling and complex, would be to vastly oversimplify things, if not to distort them. In any case, what I say will be directed toward the first question I mentioned, how might philosophy inform our reading of this passage? And I'm going to make some suggestions for how a philosophical understanding of weakness of will might inform a theological understanding of the passage. I'm basically going to reflect on this passage and draw some conclusions as a philosopher and as a Christian. Maybe this counts as philosophical theology, or maybe you want to think of what I'm doing as sermonizing in philosophical style. But in any case, I'd like to provide some material for thought and discussion, which I hope will be interesting. And in keeping with the more personal or the formational nature of this forum, I'll conclude with some pastoral reflections on the message of this particular passage for Christian academics. Please also feel free to ask me questions about this more personal side of things during the discussion, if you'd like. So, before I start, I'm going to have a sip of this beer. I just think it's so cool that I can drink while presenting a paper. I think this is the only time I've done that, so. I was debating whether I'd have like three or four like lined up, but no one else is drinking that much, so I think it wouldn't be as fun or healthy. Speaking of weakness of will, okay, so to the passage. it turns out this passage is often quoted by philosophers when discussing the topic of weakness of will. So you'll often come across this slice or these words, slice of scripture, these words from St. Paul, in, you know, philosophers who have otherwise nothing to do with Christian theology or scripture. So it's kind of like a, culturally, it's a sort of an important piece or kind of a classic expression of this. It's taken to be a fairly straightforward articulation of the problem as it's experienced by the particular individual who's considered weak. Obviously, a theological reading is going to be more complex. I want to briefly flag one of these complexities and mention that there are at least two ways of reading what's going on here. So one, and this is before I kind of get into philosophical stuff. So one is to read it as the experience of a so-called unregenerate person, a non-Christian or someone who's not a Christian who has not yet been delivered from the power of sin. And the other is to read it as the experience of a regenerate person, a Christian who has been delivered from the final consequences in condemnation of sin, that cannot entirely escape its influence in a world that's awaiting complete redemption. So there's some dispute here amongst theologians or exegetes about whether St. Paul is actually describing himself here. It seems that he is in the service of things, but maybe he's actually describing himself at a different point of time prior to his knowing Christ. There's no strong consensus among commentators as to which of these readings is correct. It seems natural to me that what St. Paul describes is a standard feature of human life, including the life of the Christian. So I guess it's just not really surprising, or it wouldn't surprise me if this were part of his own experience as he's writing this. In light of this, maybe the idea that we're still captive to sin, as St. Paul suggests in verse 23, could be taken not to mean captive in the total sense, but in a limited sense, as we display a kind of captivity in those moments when we act sinfully. This would seem to fit well with the idea that we're being redeemed by Christ, but that we still await the completion of this process in the resurrection of the body. In any case, I take something like what Paul is describing here to be a feature of all our lives. I'd be surprised if you don't experience this sort of thing. Or maybe I'm just atypical. It's quite clear that in this particular case, Paul, let's say it's Paul, is deeply divided. He's of two minds, and his state is one of disunity. Interestingly, we observe two further things. One is that he is perplexed by his own behavior. In verse 15 he says, quoting him, "I do not understand my own actions." As the commentator Joseph Fitzmyer puts it, this is quoting him, "The mystery stems from a conflict in the inmost depths of a human being, the cleavage between reason-dominated desire and actual performance. So imperious is indwelling sin that the ego acts without realizing what it is doing." End quote. We might ask how far this perplexity at oneself goes. To what extent are Paul's thoughts, as well as his deeds, opaque to him? At this moment, it seems, he grasps the law correctly, and he says that he knows what he should be doing. But perhaps maybe this realization is retrospective. He's done the bad thing, and now that he reflects on it, he can see that it was bad, but he didn't see that it was bad at the time he did it. Could this be the case? I don't see why not. The second thing we observe is that he still somehow has a correct understanding of God's law. In verse 22, he says, "For I delight in the law of God in my inmost self, but I see in my members another law at war with the law of the mind, of my mind." His state is one of disunity precisely because, though he does the wrong thing, he somehow understands the law and it resonates with him as good. But exactly how does he understand it? Further, how might we make sense of this idea that he somehow knows the law and that it is good, and yet is perplexed by the fact that he doesn't do it? What's going on in his mind? And what's going wrong psychologically so as to bring about this fractured and indeed anguished state of affairs? For philosophers, at least, the idea that one understands the correct, the good, the best course of action, and assents to it, yet doesn't do it, is at the heart of the puzzle that surrounds weakness of will. It's a puzzle because it seems in the nature of practical reason that it motivates us, at least when we're thinking clearly. In other words, when we judge that there's a good, say, some moral reason to do something, this judgment seems to, in some sense, carry with it a motivation to do that thing. This is the thesis known as judgment internalism, if any of you are familiar with it, or if any of you are doing philosophy or working philosophy. If in most cases we need some extra ingredient, like desire or feeling, aside from that reason to motivate us, it can start to look as though reason doesn't have much to do with action at all. And reason, or practical deliberation and motivation, run on parallel tracks, as it were. So the idea is that, on the one hand, with reason's internalism, on the one hand we have reason's internalism. On the other hand, reason's externalism. For internalism, reason's able to motivate actions, and this is the idea of a kind of primordial role of evaluative thought, as one person puts it, in rational action. So if I see and appreciate that there's a reason to do something, I'm immediately motivated to do it. Doesn't mean there aren't other countervailing motivations, but it means that I have a motivation that's sufficient to do the action. Whereas motivation externalism, on the other hand, holds that there's some other ingredient, some sort of desire or impulse or something else in addition to the reason that's necessary in order to motivate a person. But the problem here, like one of the criticisms of that position, is that, well, if it's not your thought that's motivating you, then how is this different from compulsion? So anyways, this is just a bit of a kind of background, kind of philosophical, conceptual background to this, related to this question. So whatever the so this reason's externalism seems to some counterintuitive or just strange. Whatever the ingredient is that provides motivation, it starts to look rather alien to the individual it's motivating, since it operates externally to her considered assessment of things or her judgment. In any case, there are some intuitive response. These are some intuitive responses to judgment externalism. Providing an account of what's going on in cases of apparent weakness of will commits one to a stance on these matters. And one wants to have a stance that's not going to be too counterintuitive. Historically, a variety of stances have been taken on this topic. There doesn't seem to be a clear consensus among philosophers at the moment as to how this, or throughout history, I suppose at the moment as well, as to how this goes. But I suppose at different times, I mean, so Donald Davidson wrote this paper, like, I don't know, like 30 years ago or something like that, that weakness of will is possible. This is like a really important paper in the discussion. And for, I guess apparently for a long time, and I think R.M. Hare had a lot to do with this, and linguistic philosophy, the entire concept of weakness of will was rejected. So that basically it wasn't, there is no such thing as weakness of will, but it's actually something else. And I guess I'll talk a little bit more about that. But yeah, so these things kind of shift around, and there's not some sort of crystal clear consensus on whether or not there is such a thing as weakness of will, properly speaking, and then secondly, what's going on. And two of the classic views I'll talk about, Aristotle and Plato. So Plato rejected weakness of will. He said, well, there's no such thing. It's actually a mistaken judgment. It's kind of cognitive error. And then Aristotle said, well, yeah, there is weakness of will, but there's a couple different ways that it can happen. So what I'll do, I'm going to briefly outline four classic views and then conclude by developing them or some thoughts related to them in relation to the text here. So I'll mention two very briefly and cover two in more detail. So two of these are from Aristotle, one is from Plato, and then one is from R.M. Hare. So Aristotle's first account is the most straightforward. So there will be, if you want to sort of pay attention, there'll be four accounts of weakness of will coming. This is the first one. It says that in cases like these, desire has overpowered reason. In book one of the Nicomachean Ethics, he describes the weak-willed person as having many impulses in contrary directions. And he says these impulses clash and struggle with reason. He doesn't develop this account too far. It's just kind of a few lines. Towards the end of the book. Though he does say that in the strong-willed person, this non-rational part of the soul at least obeys reason, this sort of the non-rational part being where desire is found, which would imply that in the weak-willed person it does not obey reason. This seems to give us the idea that in the weak-willed person, desire on the one side defeats reason on the other side, in a kind of battle between reason and desire, much in the way that Paul describes. Desire has overpowered reason. Perhaps this is how most people would describe weakness of will if they were asked to. So we can call this, I think, straightforward weakness of will. It's kind of is probably the most intuitive definition of it. So if we're not already committed to some prior position about the nature of motivation and its relation to moral judgment, we might admit that cases like this exist. Like I was saying, there are, because of philosophers' commitments to other things, they will want to actually deny that this is how it happens. But if we're not committed to that, if we just kind of look at what's going on, look at the phenomena, the experience, we'd probably be inclined to say, well, hey, this is kind of just is what it looks like. That is, it's sometimes the case that people take the lesser or the wrong course of action in full appreciation of the fact that there's a better course of action available. Reflecting on Romans 7, we could say that we require the deliverance of Christ from the chaotic pseudo-law of wayward desire, for example, when it tempts us to violate God's law. I say pseudo-law because it's lawless and uncoordinated, and therefore not so law-like by nature, even though Paul is using the term law. He's not using it necessarily in that sense. This in part defines the body of death. It also seems to fit well with the idea from verse 13, just prior to this passage, that through what is good, the law, sin might be shown to be sin, and might become sinful beyond measure. For those of us who are Christians, there is something sinful or rebellious against God in a particularly strong way, and I think in a way that's particularly destructive to our moral character, about succumbing to weakness, temptation in this particular way. This is because it has a tendency over time and through habituation, the development of a kind of habit, to become an enduring feature of our character. In other words, in time, it transitions from being a weakness of will into a defect of character, which I'll say a bit more about shortly. So let's move on to Aristotle's second, subtler, and slightly different account in Book 7 of the Nicomachean Ethics. And this is often taken to be his official account. I can stop for a drink. So here, this is like saying Book 7, he says it would be pretty incredible, like as in unbelievable, if someone could have full view of what the reasonable person or the right thing to do is, and yet not do it. He draws a distinction between what he calls active and inactive knowledge. In his words, we speak of knowing in two ways. We ascribe it both to someone who has it without using it, and to someone who is using it. This allows us to explain weakness of will by saying that the weak-willed person has knowledge of what the right thing to do is, but that knowledge isn't activated. Or in other words, the person is not attending to it, they're not paying attention to it, it's kind of buried in there somewhere, but it's not sort of really knowledge, it's not being exercised. He compares the weak-willed person to people who are asleep, who are mad, as in crazy, or drunk. He also compares them to students, which are often all three of those things. that was a bit of a joke. It's not really serious. Yeah. In case you weren't clear. it's actually a really beautiful line. He says, so he's talking about this, and then he makes a comparison to students or people who are learning, and he says, like the knowledge, they have the knowledge, but it has to grow into them. And I don't know, it's just a really beautiful line. If you think you get the knowledge, it's like a seed, and then it has to kind of like grow into your life and like into your mind and into your kind of your understanding of the world. And that's the kind of that's almost a sort of different thing, but that's the sort of thing he has in mind. It's like they have it, but they kind of before it's sort of taken root and grown, it's sort of passive or it's not fully activated and something like that. Okay, so he adds that saying the right words, the words that come from knowledge, doesn't necessarily mean that a person has knowledge, since the drunk person can recite philosophical proofs, or verses of Empedocles, as he says, like poetry, as can someone who only just learned them. But these people don't really know what they're talking about. We wouldn't think they do. It's the same with a weak-willed person. They might say the right things and appear as though they have knowledge, but their knowledge is not complete, or it's not entirely active. Aristotle thinks reasoning, including practical reasoning, happens in syllogistic fashion. As in, like, it happens according to syllogisms. If I had a whiteboard here, I'd write it out or give an illustration of it. But if you can try and sort of visualize it. The way, then, that the weak-willed person has knowledge, but not complete knowledge, is by having knowledge of the universal or the major premise of a practical syllogism, but not of the particular or the minor premise. Aristotle illustrates this with an example. Someone can know that dry things benefit every human being and that he himself is a human being, but he might not have or activate the knowledge that this particular thing is dry. A person in this case would have knowledge of or would be using the universal major premise, but they would not have knowledge of or they wouldn't be using the particular minor premise. So the major premise is like dry meat is good. He's talking about meat in this case. So dry meat is good for you. It's healthy. Here is a piece of dry meat. So that's the major premise. The minor premise is here is a piece of dry meat. And then if you can kind of put those two together, it issues a decision to take the dry meat and to eat it. I don't know if that helps. Okay, so in a case of weakness of will, desire, or appetite as he says, leads the person to ignore or suppress the particular minor premise. So the person could have knowledge that some action is bad, say that it's bad to break one's Lenten resolutions, which include to not eat cake. But they fail to see, or they deceive themselves so as to prevent them from seeing, that some particular action falls under that category. Say that I'm really breaking my Lenten resolutions as I have the cake. So I might explain to myself, surely the purpose of the resolution wasn't to prevent me from enjoying afternoon snacks that are beneficial to my work routine. They give me sort of energy and enjoyment. Or they might say, when I made the resolution, what I really meant was that I should pursue a healthy diet. And I've been eating pretty well lately. Plus, this cake is really a healthy cake. It has lots of dried fruit and nuts. So this is what Aristotle means when he says that the weak-willed person both has knowledge in a way and does not have it. For what it's worth, he's partly agreeing with Socrates when he says in the Protagoras that knowledge cannot be dragged around like a slave. Since Aristotle says the universal, or the major premise, remains intact in the weak-willed agent, but he's partly disagreeing since he says the particular minor premise can fluctuate. It can come and go, or it can be suppressed. However, he doesn't see this as a problem for knowledge, because this is a knowledge of particulars, and not, for example, first principles. It's perceptual knowledge, as he says, and not the sort that seems to be fully knowledge. So let's call this indirect weakness of will. So far we have straightforward weakness of will, now we have indirect weakness of will. If we hold that there's such a thing as straightforward weakness of will, I don't think this necessarily prevents us from acknowledging cases of indirect weakness of will. In fact, this could be in part what's going on in Romans 7. In verses 22 to 23, Paul acknowledges and delights in the will of God in his mind and inmost self. Yet he sees that the law of his members is in conflict with this. So basically, as I was saying earlier, it's just that these two things don't seem to be incompatible or mutually exclusive. Interestingly, the word that St. Paul uses for mind, which is nous in Greek, is also used by Aristotle to express the ability to intellectually apprehend or understand first principles, major premises, including the nature of the good life, primarily as the virtuous life, or the life of well-reasoned activity performed with excellence. If this is correct, Paul might be saying something analogous to what Aristotle was saying, namely that he apprehends the law, the major premise, and yet something goes wrong when he tries to apply this to his life. His perception is distorted, and he's misreading the minor premise. As I've mentioned, in verse 15, Paul tells us that he somehow doesn't understand his actions. And perhaps he only fully grasps their sinfulness retrospectively, on reflection, or being told by, say, a Christian friend. So he might already have reason to believe that this weakness is affecting his mind. His body of death is not only physical, but intellectual, too. Which is kind of interesting. So he's crying out for redemption in both body and mind. This redemption will include the correction and liberation of his sight from the distorting effects of sin. Or we might say his perceptual knowledge, including how he reads other people in the world that surrounds him. My idea here is to broaden how we think of weakness of will. It's not just direct and self-conscious defiance of God's law. Sin works its way into the fabric of our mind. There are different ways of knowing what's good and right, layers of complexity. And knowledge of one true thing, even though it's the most important thing, the major premise, doesn't guarantee knowledge of how we should apply it in action, or that we're applying it correctly. So we might have the right first principles, but that doesn't guarantee that we know how to apply them in our circumstances. So we can often, I think, misapply them, and sometimes with disastrous consequences. As people who spend much of our time in thought and study developing our minds, this is something that we should be attentive to, especially since this happens quite subtly, in the twilight of a kind of half-reason. So that's Aristotle's view of weakness of will in short. Socrates, on the other hand, so just to sum up, we have two views from Aristotle. We've got the first kind of direct or straightforward weakness of will. This kind of is the way it seems. Your reason overpower, rather your desires overpower your reason, and you do what you shouldn't do in full view of the facts. And you have the second one, where your desires kind of go to work on your mind and your knowledge in a way, and so things start appearing differently to you. So I mean, a kind of innocent, kind of banal example, but this idea of like breaking a Lenten resolution. Well, maybe it's not. Maybe it's a very grievous sin. I don't know. You've resolved not to eat sweets during Lent, and then you start, you really want some, something sweet, and you start kind of, you sort of allow this thought in, or this desire kind of into your mind. It starts kind of niggling its way through through your knowledge, and you start thinking, well, it's not really a sweet, it's actually healthy cake, this sort of thing. So you can see how they kind of, there's a kind of warping of the mind and of in that sense particular knowledge, even though you have the main principle is still intact. So that's just a summary so far of Aristotle's two views. So Socrates, on the other hand, in the Protagoras, basically denies that there is such a thing as weakness of will, mostly because he believes human beings never choose to act against their better judgment. And this is I guess, somewhat counterintuitive. So if it sounds a bit weird, it might be because it is. Or maybe he's right, I don't know. So what appears to be weakness of will actually follows from a mistaken judgment about what is good. So put differently, it's a result of ignorance. So it's just like an intellectual or cognitive mistake. People who are apparently weak-willed do what they do because they don't grasp the proper value of goods or courses of action in question. They commit an intellectual error. Because of this error, they don't properly measure the goods on offer and assign to them the correct value or weight. We might say that their vision is distorted and their scales for measuring good and bad or the value of things are uncalibrated or improperly calibrated. The apparently weak-willed person, the person who looks like they're doing something weak-willed, doesn't have correct knowledge of pleasure and pain, good and bad. So we could call this, if we wanted to give it a name, weakness of will is intellectual error. As such, it's not properly weakness of will, but it's actually mistaken judgment. I don't think that we can say that this describes what Paul is talking about in Romans 7. At least it doesn't seem that way to me. So I'm not going to say much more about it, except that there's a natural way to remedy this through education, as well as good friends and mentors. Instead, I'll look at a variation on this, which we might call weakness of will as insidious intellectual error. This is something discussed by R.M. Hare. So R.M. Hare used to be, he's the White's professor of moral philosophy here in Oxford at Corpus. So he was very influential in like moral philosophy for a period of time, 20th century. Like Socrates, Hare denies that weakness of will actually happens, at least as such, or under that description. But Hare believes this follows from the nature of moral language. He believes that moral language is inherently prescriptive, because terms like ought, should, and good, these evaluative terms, for example, carry with them more than a description of some state of affairs. They carry with them a kind of moral instruction. That is, they commend a certain state of affairs as worth attaining, or some course of action is worth pursuing. They prescribe certain states of affairs or actions as generally or universally worthwhile. So they're prescriptive in this sense. They just prescribe, they say you should do certain things when they imply this. The idea that a person, both oneself and others, should pursue a course of action is built into the words themselves. Moral language is in this way prescriptive. It's therefore inescapable that if you accept certain moral terms, you are committing yourself to certain universal principles over and above the use of a word in a certain way. The central use of moral judgments on this picture is to guide conduct. It seems to me that most of us who are Christians use Christian moral language in the same way. Whether that's the language of Scripture or some theological belief related to it, or not related to it. That's just to say that the expectation is that when we say these things, we take them to be true for us. Otherwise, we're not using them properly. Hare's idea is that if moral language has this property, it's going to be impossible to accept some moral judgment and yet act contrary to it. Saying these things is tantamount to making a moral judgment. The central function of moral judgments is to guide action. So if judging I ought to do something entails that I'm committed to it, then it would seem that I can't say something and not do it. But people do this all the time, which would appear to present a difficulty for this theory. In short, Hare's answer to this is that when people say, for example, that they ought to do something and then they don't do it, they either mean what they say and it's impossible for them to do it, so they're under some kind of compulsion, it's like physically or psychologically impossible, or they don't really mean what they say. Hare points out that it's natural to describe this using the metaphor of a divided personality. He actually cites St. Paul in his book. He suggests that there are two ways this metaphor can go, this metaphor of divided personality. One is that the person in question is actually incapable of acting the way they say, and perhaps genuinely believe they ought to act. They're incapable of so acting because they're in the grip of some terribly strong force. This is what I said, this is in cases of compulsion. The barrier here to doing the good thing is a kind of psychological impossibility that approximates physical impossibility. It appears not to be weakness of will, but a straightforward case of compulsion, for which the individual in question does not deserve blame, since the person can't do otherwise. The second interpretation he has in mind is more interesting. It's where the person in question is perfectly able to do otherwise and to resist temptation, but they don't actually mean what they say. Such a person is insincere, or in the worst case, self-deceived. These are the two possibilities. Hare says, quoting him, he thinks that he ought to do something, but he has escaped his own notice, using ought in an off-color way. Now, there may be many variations on this sort of thing. Someone might lack complete conviction. They could be lazy, they could be unsure, they could be mindlessly uttering conventional beliefs, or they might surreptitiously be inserting escape clauses into their moral proclamations, whether self-consciously or not. Hare talks about the lattermost practice in terms of Janus words and special pleading. For example, when we say that, you know, we really should do something, but we don't actually mean it, and we might in this case be inviting our audience or our hearer to affirm that we're in a special case and the action or the duty in question doesn't really apply to us. So if I say, I really should help so-and-so out, you know, I should help my friend move, I really should, but, you know, there's a kind of way that we use our language, I guess. It's just that this is just what he's pointing out to, that we don't actually mean it. We're kind of sort of suggesting to the person that this should, this kind of this moral, you know, imperative applies to in some kind of a diminished sense, or applies in a diminished sense. So this is this idea of special pleading. And I'm sure we could come up with examples of this. In any case, it's not a genuine use of moral language. Hare argues that this leaves the general prescriptive nature of moral judgment and language intact. Because in these cases, people aren't using genuinely prescriptive language. They're using language in an insincere or off-color way. However, to operate in this way, permissible, for example, ironic circumstances aside, when there's a kind of when it's intentional, where there's a kind of understood meaning that this is being played off of, and these kind of acceptable, or like I say, permissible exceptions aside, to operate in this way manifests a lack of integrity. And so this is what we might call weakness of will as insidious intellectual error. So let's return to what Paul says in Romans 7. I want to suggest that this notion of insidious intellectual error might further illuminate how we understand what this passage is saying. As we've seen, Paul is both conflicted and confused, and there might be a sense in which he only realizes that his actions are sinful retrospectively. So far, I've suggested that we're permitted to understand him as talking about both straightforward weakness of will and indirect weakness of will. On the same grounds, and with a little bit of creativity, I'd like to suggest that there might also be room to understand him as describing this kind of insidious intellectual error, by which we change the meaning of our moral terms so that they no longer apply to us, or the way we once believed them to. This is something typically only known retrospectively, when it is known. On logical grounds, I so far don't see any reason to deny that all three of these can happen, though at different times. In other words, they don't seem to be mutually exclusive. What we have then is another way in which the body of death from which Paul longs to be delivered seeps into the fabric of the human mind, and once there, causes problems. This kind of deepening of this sin the mind. I now want to draw some general conclusions before I wrap up with some very simple but I think important pastoral points. I've suggested that this passage might allow us to believe that there are three types of weakness of will. Of course, I'm excluding the Socratic ideas not applicable to this passage. Or properly, two types of weakness of will and one type of apparent weakness of will. Because Hare's idea is actually not weakness of will, it's this intellectual error, a certain species of intellectual error. Again, these are straightforward weakness of will, indirect weakness of will, two coming from Aristotle, and then Hare's idea of insidious intellectual error. I think we're all guilty of each of these at one time or another. For the record, I love humankind, including individuals. And I am optimistic about people's ability to change. But both the ability to change and the ability to love are helped along by honesty with ourselves and others. Only God knows all the ways that we try to deceive ourselves into thinking we're morally better than we are, or we're justified in doing one thing rather than another. What I'm saying is that Paul's words in this passage should alert us to these several kinds of culpable weakness, or cases of impermissible moral indulgence. And if we could know ourselves fully, if we were fully transparent to ourselves as we are to God, I'm confident that we would find we display each of these kinds of weakness or sin. And to sort of borrow words from one version of the confession, sin through negligence, weakness, and our own deliberate fault. But of course, it's in the nature of these things that they are difficult to be known. So we count on one another and God to make us aware of these things, as by his grace and through the work of Christ, we journey along in the process of sanctification. I want to draw one further philosophical and perhaps in ways theological conclusion. In addition to these being three distinct forms of culpable weakness, I wonder if they're not often linked in a certain pattern of progression. Though this might be an over-tidy picture of things, there does seem to be a path, not the only path to be sure, from straightforward weakness of will to what I've called insidious intellectual error. Something might begin as an instance of weakness of will in the straightforward sense. We might cave into temptation in full view of the fact that what we're doing is wrong. But in time, our mind will go to work on itself to convince us that it's not wrong, or at least not as wrong as it seems. In fact, it doesn't take much time or effort at all to convince yourself that your sin isn't as bad as it seems. And before you know it, it seems less bad than it is. We might find that we still see, understand, and perhaps delight in what's right and good. But if we allow this to go on without correction, it may be that the way that we see things will become distorted. The way the world shows up to us will be warped, and we become more susceptible to indirect weakness of will, roughly along the lines that Aristotle set out. Don't worry, it's coming to a close soon. In time, as we adjust to thinking and seeing the world this way, we may find that we lose view of what's right and good as such. God's law, or the prospect of life in communion or relationship with Him, is no longer something we grasp intuitively or something that we delight in. This would be to slide into what I've called insidious intellectual error. I take this to be part of the hardening of heart that results from sin. In its strongest form, it's a quality incompatible with Christian faith. St. Paul speaks of this in Ephesians 4, verses 17 to 18. He says, "You must no longer live as the Gentiles live, in the futility of their minds. They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of their ignorance and hardness of heart." He seems to be speaking of futility of mind here in the sense that the presumably unbelieving Gentiles have no grasp of or delight in God's law as such. Put differently, we might say that their major premise is wrong, or if a Christian were in such a position that it had been knocked out. This is one endpoint to caving into temptation, unbelief. My point is that there's an intellectual or a cognitive process of habituation at work here, a kind of half-conscious re-education in what Christians would call sin that we need to be aware of. In a form less strong but no less harmful, this hardening of heart, or this, in other words, insidious intellectual error, might bring us to hold on to certain theological language, for example, concerning the nature of God's law and what it means to live in communion with Him, but in such a way that what this language actually means has been changed. I think we need to be particularly cautious about this as people who engage in intellectual work, and particularly as people who do or engage with theology. I think there is a general temptation to bend any particular piece of doctrine in the way that we find to be most convenient for our personal or professional purposes. These purposes could include a variety of things, like, for example, a certain freedom in some area of our personal life, or a successful career as an academic. Of course, this doesn't rule out a change in one's views according to conscience. But changes like these should come after the appropriate amount of prayer, consultation with close friends and mentors, and general soul searching. I'm also not entirely naive about the genuine disputability of much doctrine. These matters are complex, and I think we should be free to take a different stance according to conscience. But the devil is in the details. We can easily deceive ourselves, believing we're entitled to a certain definition or position, say that we've discharged all of our moral and intellectual duties. I guess I'm just saying that we should be careful of this. My final, very simple pastoral point is that there's a way to avoid both specific instances of culpable weakness and the progression from straightforward weakness to more insidious forms of self-deceit. Pray, read the Bible, go to church, surround yourself with good people or community, confess your sins, Protestants can do this too, have one or two very good friends who care about you and whose judgment you trust, and spend time with them. Have one or two mentors of the same kind and talk with them from time to time. In no way do I say this in a throwaway fashion. In my experience, all of these things have been crucial to whatever virtue and soundness of mine I presently possess. I don't need to remind you that I speak as a work in progress. I'll let you be a judge of my soundness of mind. On the topic of sin, confession, and community, I'd like to leave us with some thoughts from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, his beautiful little book, Life Together. Most of you will have read this already, but it's worth repeating. So these are Bonhoeffer's words. Sin demands to have a man by himself. it withdraws him from the community. The more isolated a person is, the more destructive will be the power of sin over him. And the more deeply he becomes involved in it, the more disastrous is his isolation. Sin wants to remain unknown. It shuns the light. In the darkness of the unexpected, it poisons the whole being of a person. This can happen even in the midst of a pious community. In fact, from personal experience, too often it does. In confession, the light of the gospel breaks into the darkness and seclusion of the heart. The sin must be brought into the light. The unexpressed must be openly spoken and acknowledged. All that is secret and hidden is made manifest. It is a hard struggle until the sin is openly admitted, but God breaks gates of brass and bars of iron, alluding to Psalm 107. We are members of the body of Christ. His death on the cross provides the means by which we are redeemed from our body of death. So in the words of St. Paul, thanks be to God. The end.
Thank you so much, Paul. That was very, very rich and thought-provoking. I open up to questions. Does anyone have any burning to ask?
Carl, since we always argue about evolution.
Oh dear, what do we argue about?
Well, it shouldn't be an exception, right? I wanted to ask you about, from the perspective of evolutionary neuroscience, I guess, like Dan Kahneman's thinking fast, thinking slow, or Antonio Damasio's Descartes' error, right? It's kind of challenging the whole presupposition that we're really rational beings, or at least suggests that our emotional will overrides our intellectual will, so to say, our intellectual mind.
It suggests that the emotional overrides the intellectual?
Well, that emotional is primary, yes, and it kind of has the stronger influence. So I guess when I read that particular passage in scriptures, from that perspective, it does make sense to me. It seems quite natural. Because, again, that sort of emotional will kind of take that primary role, and it will be harder.
That is the body
of death in a way.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how to marry that with Aristotle, but I wanted, like you talked about perceptual knowledge, I'm not quite sure what exactly that is. If you could maybe talk a little bit more about that, but also do you have any thoughts on what to do with evolutionary neuroscience from that perspective?
Oh, great, yeah. Well, okay, so I think when Aristotle talks about, so that's, if I remember correctly, that's actually like straight from this translation. I'm using Terry Irwin's translation of the Nicomachean Ethics. So it's Aristotle's term, which is just to say that it's nothing more than what he means in that specific instance, which is to say that it's basically just knowledge of particulars. So as opposed to knowledge of first principles, like the nature of the good life, those are things that we grasp intuitively by the mind. Well, like the nature of the good life. So, eudaimonia, that human flourishing is happiness, and that's has a virtuous element. It's, you know, excellence in intellectual achievement and moral achievement and so forth. So all those things are first principles for Aristotle, or they're kind of united in the first principle of what eudaimonia is. And that's something that we just know. So that's this idea of like intellectual apprehension, or it's intuitive knowledge. And then on the other hand, so that's on sort of the one end, that's a kind of like first principle. And then on the bottom end, or the opposite end, we have particular knowledge, which is basically knowledge of the world that we live in. So it's like empirical knowledge, you might say. Though that term could be possibly misleading, but it's just this idea this is why, for example, Aristotle thinks that you need to be, like, the young person cannot have practical wisdom, because practical wisdom requires this kind of particular knowledge, which is knowledge of, you know, other people, society, cause and effect relations. And so in order to be fully virtuous, you need to understand that whole network of relations in order to kind of enact virtue. Anyway, so perceptual knowledge, in this sense, it's like being able to kind of like read reality in the right way. So it's that kind of particular knowledge. And that would be different from, say, knowledge of what the good thing is and the good principle is, say, if there's a good principle. Is that clear enough?
Yes.
Okay.
That is.
And then what was the other question? Just sort of general thoughts on Kahneman.
Affective sort of.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Well, So I've read a little bit of Kahneman, and it makes sense. And I think, I forget exactly Damasio's idea, with Kahneman, this idea of A system, thinking system, was it A and B?
Dual processing.
Dual processing?
Yeah.
Well, I can't speak to the details, but it seems like prima facie to map on quite well with the kind of traditional Aristotelian idea of virtue. Because you have these initial kind of dispositions, or these virtues, and they're gonna entail or involve some sort of reflex and a kind of you don't have to, it's not necessarily a calculated response in every case. But that's the whole point of habituation, is that you use your reflective mind, your kind of slow processing, to kind of think through and then kind of put yourself in certain situations, and that will cause, shape your character a certain way. So, when Aristotle talks about straightening a stick that's bent, you're going to bend it the other way. So if someone's a coward, then maybe just a very kind of crass example, but a course of action that would be conducive to the development of courage would be to just be brash and run out into, on the rugby pitch or something like that, just charge ahead and get pummeled, and then he might kind of get used to it, and then he can kind of ease back into, I'm not saying that that's actually going to work, but that's kind of the idea, right? So anyway, so you kind of you think about it, and then you try and you train yourself, put yourself in certain circumstances that will sort of shape you, and then these kind of fast responses, or these more reflexive things, you'll just kind of acquire those in time. Is that clear enough? Did I say that clearly enough?
Somewhat.
So.
But I don't know. Take all of the time.
That's an interesting question, but
feel free to get more drinks and food if you like. Don't feel need to sit.
I've got a question.
Can
I ask, how do you, as talking to it from a purely from a Christian sort of theological point of view, how do you fit this passage into the trajectory of the whole letter? So with Romans 8 straight away afterwards, how do you, do we have, does our pneumatology help with weak will? How do we fit that sort of, verse, to set the mind on the flesh is death, but to set the mind on the spirit is life and peace. For those who live with their minds according to the spirit will have their minds set on things of the spirit. Which seems to me as though, in a sense, Paul is answering his own question. He's taking us on a journey. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Not really.
That's
all right. So I initially titled this "Some Limited Philosophical Reflections." I mean, that's going beyond what I'm trying to do here.
No, I know. I was just wondering you felt that actually some of these issues about being will from a pastoral point of view, because you were talking about prayer and good counsel. Ultimately, isn't it to do with the fact that we are reborn as if in faith, and therefore the new life helps us.
But how do we cash that out? What does that look like?
Well, I think Paul is pretty specific, isn't he? With those the following verses, this thing about those who have their minds set, those who live according to. He's quite instructive in those verses. So I suppose for each person that will look different. But I was interested in this relationship of the mind, because you mentioned that earlier.
Yeah.
Having your mind set on the spirit.
Yeah.
It seemed to be something that's quite other, or might be quite helpful if you...
I guess I'm struggling to kind of think through what that kind of tangibly looks like. I guess that would mean that... So my kind of crew kind of like non-academic theology, I'd say like, well, it means kind of like focusing on God, like turning to God and inviting Him to transform us.
Well, I mean, I think that, I mean, but I'm asking.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
So that, but that seems to me like a very, it's kind of like, okay, well that, what is that? I guess it's just kind of an obvious point.
Well, it's something as a philosopher, you have to believe in body, mind, soul, and spirit, I suppose, because actually if we don't have an understanding of spirit, then we are probably all stuck back in chapter 7. But if we have a belief of being reborn in the power of the spirit, then we actually get to live in the power of chapter 8.
Right, okay, I see. So basically, well, this needs to be complemented by a kind of, by what you say, pneumatology, like an account of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah,
okay, so that's something I didn't explicitly talk about. That's something that I assume in my own, you know, beliefs, that is kind of like guiding and kind of along, like a part of this whole process, right?
I think that there is, because you don't want to get stuck with your pastoral things at the end thinking that there is, that it's all about us working.
Sure.
Having to work it out
for
ourselves, because ultimately isn't the promise of being a Christian that actually we're given the ability.
Yeah.
That actually ultimately,
right.
In a sense, from a pastoral point of view, people are really struggling with weak will over a particular moral issue or a particular sin or whatever. Ultimately, grace is given.
Okay, that's what you're going
through.
Going
the
on.
Power.
I
so
see.
As a minister, you'd be wanting to say that there you don't have to bash yourself over the head for the rest of your life with this sort of weak will thing, because actually we're promised a way out, which is actually through chapter 8.
Sure. Okay, no, that makes sense.
Good.
That sounds good.
That in itself can become problematic, as I'm discovering in my own research on
yes,
so,
do tell.
Jonathan Edwards, who's completely in interaction with all this stuff with Butler, with sort of these developments on ideas of the affections in the 18th century, was a Calvinist and thought that the transformation that you're talking about sort of occurs at the level of the affections. So true religion, when you convert, when you become a true Christian, your affections themselves are transformed so that you have a compulsion towards loving God and an aversion to evil, right? Which is an aversion to sin, which is sort of within you. So there's a literal alteration of your character in a supernatural event, right? But it turns out a lot of the people who really sort of imbibed these doctrines and took them to heart then became obsessed about whether they're actually experiencing this sense of a transformed character, right? So it becomes its own kind of problem then when you're trying to determine whether you've actually experienced the Spirit's inner work if you don't actually feel transformed, right? If you find yourself kind of locked within these patterns of sin, or in one particular case study I'm currently working on, which is driving me crazy to some extent. But anyway, it's an interesting thing. I don't know if you've come across Edwards at all in your in thinking about this stuff, like but he's sort of entering into this within the sort of Hobbesian world where there's sort of Hobbes is saying that, well, we're all, you know, that people are essentially inclined towards self-interest, self-love, and then Butler and others are, and Shaftesbury and other 18th century figures are saying, well, actually we have these inclinations that are actually naturally good, and so he's sort of entering into that, sort of agreeing with Hobbes, but then saying that there's this dramatic transformation that happens through a supernatural event in conversion, but then that itself becomes something that can turn in on itself and drive people crazy, apparently. So
yeah.
Because I suppose pastorally you need both, don't you? You need both chapter 7 and 8, because you need that bracing realism of chapter 7. Yeah, we recognise that even though you know what's good, you can't do it for some reason. But there is the hope of transformation of the Spirit, and it's always open to us, and we can ask for it and we can receive it. But it's never going to be complete in this life anyway.
Well, I was going to say, I guess you did, because there was the question of like, what do we actually do to achieve this transformation or whatever, but I guess you did actually point some things out, like the quotation you ended with, which was sort of on about confession as something that literally you're bringing sin out into the light, which is something that you can literally do in communal practice or whatever, which then affects the transformation, right? Or at least potentially. And so if you start to implement those things, whatever those might be, then those are ways that can practically manifest itself in community or whatever.
I guess my question, sort of, I was going to ask a question, but then you raised Ed was an R. You're asking my question. So, because my understanding of the will is, let's say I want to have that crisp over there. Two things. There's an aspect of knowledge as to whether it's good for me or too much calories in there, maybe I should reduce it, or my appetite for that moment. And so, in that moment, I have to make a decision. And at that moment, my will is either strong or it's weak. And so, just comparing to, because Ed Wallace used the phrase, you know, we make decisions based on our strongest inclinations at the given moment. Now, that can create an impression that it's your desire that is sort of attacking you at that moment to make that decision. And so, the questions I want to ask from the passage of Paul is, I guess, reading it briefly, you might get the impression that it's a desire which is the fallen element of you, and it's your desire that is pulling you away, and somehow you have to maintain this rational understanding of who God is and who you are in relation with Him. But then also we know from scripture that says, you know, we should not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of our minds.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question then is, I mean, from that passage, if one reads in isolation, you get the impression that the aspect of you that is fallen is your desires. Also, you get the impression that the aspect that is fallen about you is also your rational parts of your mind. And I know some have debated whether how far or how much we've fallen is it the rational part or the desire part. And so the question then is, when one is at that very moment when you have to make a decision and your will can either go to the left or to the right, what is that source of weakness? So if I may put ourselves in that very moment, and if I was to sort of pinpoint what is that motivating factor, what is that catalyst that makes me swing to left or right? I mean, what would that be? Well, I mean, is it a combination of my rational mind, information, knowledge, how I feel, my perception, or are there bits and bobs that seems to isolate itself from each other? Because from this section, I get the impression that Paul, although not necessarily in that context, was talking a lot about his desires, warring against him, and somehow he has to remind himself of the reality of the truth of the gospel. And so is it always the desire, or is it a question of, I don't have any complete knowledge, or should it be that we should seek for complete knowledge so that we use that complete knowledge to battle our desire? Do you know what I mean? You know, so it's, what is that? So I think it's almost like on a pastoral element, you know, when we face a situation whereby our will has been assaulted, and we experience weakness in our will, what is our go-to, if that makes sense? I mean, do we start to see our desires as the problem, or do we start seeing that we have an incomplete knowledge? Should we seek for complete knowledge, which if there's such a thing as complete knowledge? And so what is that, and it's a big question, but what is that, what do you do? I mean, it's almost like a simple ABC question. What do you do beyond that? Because you know, at that very moment, your will make a decision, but the decision you make, and according to Edwards, is based on your strongest inclination at that moment. But then what is that source of the strong inclination? Is it a desire or the magnitude of my knowledge? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess, okay, so I just have like a few thoughts.
Yes.
I'm not really sure how to answer that exactly, but one thought is that there is a way of looking at decision as just a kind of like, I think, or motivation and decision and action as a kind of like, it's like John McDowell called like a hydraulic model, which is kind of like whatever desires kind of push around and, you know, whatever sort of some, you know, whatever direction they go in is sort of what happens. But then I think a lot of, and this is, I think, the sort of this is a bit of the bite of reason's internalism, is that he rejects that picture and says, well, if you can see that you have a reason to do something, you can make a decision, you can make a choice to act on that reason, whatever your desires are. So there's a kind of like bigger philosophical problem or question behind this. And I don't really know the answer to that, but I think I'm inclined to say that, no matter what my desires are, I can still, if I can see a certain course of action, then I can act on it. Those are my philosophical intuitions. So okay, so that's one point. Another point is, okay, yeah, so your question is like, what's going on in that moment of decision, and then what are our resources, or what do we draw on in order to make the right decision? Well, I guess, I mean, really what I've given is several accounts of what's going on in that instance. So I've said that they're not mutually exclusive, or they're compatible. So it could be either a kind of overwhelming desire that's swamping your reason, or your ability to kind of think clearly. It could be that you've because you're sort of craving a certain thing, say it's a certain type of temptation. Whether I don't know what sort of the most kind of likely temptation, or the one that is sort of most visible, maybe it's kind of like, I don't know, say sexual temptation or something like that. You keep lusting, or kind of craving this thing that you know is not good for you, but you kind of harbor this desire, and sooner or later it starts to kind of chip away at your resolve and your kind of your clarity, your ability to kind of read the situation properly. So that's there's sort of deeper ways that can happen. So I guess. Okay, so I think those are just accounts, basically, of what's going on.
Yeah.
And then, what resources to draw on? Well, okay, so I think, don't misunderstand me to think that I'm giving like a complete theological account here. I'm just giving sort of an analysis of the problem and a few ways forward and ways that we can kind of incorporate or certain practices that we can adopt in order to respond to this. And in terms of the theology behind it, it goes at this moment in time. It certainly goes beyond my what I kind of know about theology. But I guess keep that in mind. But I mean, I guess it's okay. So then maybe how does it work? So in that, so it could be. So I suppose that as we appeal to God in prayer, I mean, does he alter our desires? I mean, yeah, he does. Okay, so he.
I think he. Well, I don't know alter, but I think there's an aligning.
Yeah.
There's a.
Yeah,
there's
he can kind of like. I mean, this is how I think of prayer. It's kind of like, I appeal like God, like help me to do this, and then it's kind of like I gradually kind of become.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think. So that can kind of hit the desire thing, and then I guess what I'm saying, this is one of my big kind of points of the paper, is like, because I think often we think about desires, it's sort of what, when we talk about weakness of will and sort of thing, but there's like a significant like cognitive or intellectual side to this as well, which is what I wanted to draw attention to. And so I think that's another thing where it's like, God, like, straighten out my mind, like purify my mind, give me, help me sort of see the world as it is, and as you've made it, and to see what's good, what's really good, and what really matters here. And so I think it's a kind of like all the way through sort of cleansing, ideally, by God's grace. And I guess that's the pneumatology thing. I mean, the Holy Spirit, as we believe. And that's kind of, I guess it's kind of how it works. I mean, as far as like sort of ontologically what's going on, I don't know, but it just seems very mysterious, but I've got to describe what it would look like from a philosophical vantage point. And I guess that's all I'm setting out to do here, because I'm sort of offering you what I have.
A book that's interesting on this, that's not academic really, but it's called Teach Us to Want.
Yeah.
By Jen Pollock-Michelle, I'd recommend that. It's a good kind of thinking about what desire looks like in our lives and how it changes and how it doesn't change. And yeah, that's interesting. Maybe just one more question before we wrap up kind of formally. Jen?
I think what actually I think I saw that one over there. Let's take two.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
With regard to the cognitive side,
yeah,
the insidious intellectual error, is this seen as a universal human condition, or do certain individuals suffer from it pathologically, continually self-deceiving every few minutes? You know?
Yeah, I think so. I guess the way I'm suggesting, I'm suggesting that it's a universal condition, that it's something that we all certainly can do and probably are currently doing, you know, right now in some domain of our lives. So I think it's something that is universal. I suppose, maybe certain pathologies would incline you to do that more often, I'm not sure. But I think it's universal. I think Hare meant it that way as well.
Thank you.
Joe.
Can I suggest that you're not going to really get into Paul's practical teaching if you stay in chapter 7 and 8 and don't go on to chapter 12, which is his practical teaching.
Right.
Whereas he gets in the beginning of chapter 12, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind.
Yeah.
Paul is very conscious that God has made us as persons of pattern. We are habituated to some things rightly and some things wrongly. So as he goes on all through chapter 12, he's continual contrasts of what is the good to do and the wrong to avoid. In each case, you're replacing the wrong with the good, and the final do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Now, patterns, habituation, this is expressed in another way in Ephesians and Colossians, where he talks about put off the old man, sort of thing he's talking about in Romans 7, and put on the new man. And that is not some vague, general, spiritual thing to do. It's very practical. It means stop the old habits. But it is not possible to stop a habit by trying to stop it. You can only stop a habit by changing it for a good habit. So, let the thief steal no longer. When is a thief not a thief? Well, not merely when he's not stealing, because maybe he's on holiday, maybe he's in prison, maybe he has enough for the moment. Let the thief steal no longer, but let him rather work so that he has something to give. A thief is no longer a thief when he is working and giving to someone else. And that's a very practical thing that he then goes on.
What if he starts thieving, you know, when he's done giving to someone else?
Well, he may have stopped thieving, but his mentality hasn't changed until he's working for himself. At the very least, it has to be that change.
Yeah.
Working rather than stealing. Mm-hmm. But in all of these things, it's a very practical, put off the old habits and put on a new habit, which you take time to think through. Now, what is it that when I'm faced with this particular temptation that I do instead? Just trying to resist it won't do the trick. You've got to do something else in place of it. So I would say it's not a matter of weakness of will, it's a matter of strength of the wrong habituation. And the only way to change a habit is to replace it with a new habit, not merely to stop it. So that's my suggestion of a way to get on to seeing Paul's practical approach and how it fits in with your philosophical approach, I don't know. But if you want to do further reading on it, I would suggest Jay Adams' books on counseling.
So hopefully I've given you a rich description of the problem, and someone else can give a nice description of this theological account of the solution.
Thank you so much. Given you stay around for a little bit longer, we've got room for about 20 minutes.
We can go up to the
bar afterwards, so if you'd like to, yeah. But yeah, thank you very much, Carl, for re-simulating.
Thank you.